Today is Wednesday. It's January 11th, 2023. Hi, this is John Williams. It's 2:44 in the afternoon, and this is the Mincing Rascals podcast, portions of which can be frequently heard on WGN Radio at 8 o'clock on Saturday nights. You can hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Mark Guarino, and I'm a Chicago journalist whose byline you can find in places like WBZ and the Washington Post, New York Times, and other outlets.
I'm Mark Jacob. I'm a former Chicago Tribune Metro editor, former Chicago Sun-Times Sunday editor, and now just a plain old freelance writer.
I'm Eric Zorn, the editor and publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, a newsletter on Substack, and I'm feeling a little bittersweet today.
What are you bittersweet about?
I'm bittersweet about the fact that Heather Sharon has
Great
new gig. She's going to be a fellow at the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, and she's going to keep her job at Channel 11, but it's going to severely curtail her appearances on the Mincing Rascals. She's out indefinitely, so we have to wish her the best and hope that someday she comes back to join us.
A fellowship at the University of Chicago sounds pretty sweet, although I don't even know what that is, but I want one of those. What do you do when you're a fellow? Have any of you guys been fellows? Hey, fellows, have any of you guys been fellows?
I am a fellow, but have not been one.
I did a 2-week fellowship in Japan once, which was fun because all I did is write about baseball and robots.
So somebody hires you to go?
No, this institute in Japan didn't think it was getting enough attention from American news media, so they reached out and through the consulate here in Chicago and shipped me over there.
I don't even know what fellows do. I'm assuming they participate in group discussions, maybe give some speeches, lend some gloss to the institution. I'm not sure, but it sounds great. Write a great line on your resume. So
it's a 6-month gig for her, but I asked her off the air today. She and I spoke, and she says, I can't be part of the Rascals anymore because with Channel 11 and the fellowship. I said, well, you're not going to have time or you're not going to have permission. And she sort of said yes. I was kidding Eric. I said, I think she just doesn't want to be in the Rascals anymore because last we visited, I'm not sure if this made it to the podcast. It might have been part of our video pre-roll, but Eric was critiquing the move by Channel 11 to putting the Chicago Tonight nightly newscast from an hour to a half hour and moving it to 10 o'clock at night. You went on at some length, Eric, about what a bad move you thought that was going to be.
I did. I think that the show belongs at 7 o'clock. I don't really care for it at 10 o'clock. It's going to be moving there on January 23rd. Although I do think that it's a sharper program when it's half an hour rather than an hour. It's cut to half an hour during their pledge periods when they're going to show the River Dance or the Three Tenors or whatever else they show in the extra half hour to draw donations. That when it is reduced to half an hour, it's often much more focused, a much more vital show. Sometimes an hour feels like they're just filling time occasionally. And I don't think Heather took offense at that.
I don't know that she took offense, but I don't think she agreed.
I don't think she agreed, but I mean, she and I had a nice conversation today on the phone as well. So I don't think there's bad blood there.
No. Well, I'm trying not to foment that. And maybe I'm a little bit, but
you certainly do try to foment that.
Well, I appreciated your candor when you were talking with us last time about that. And to be honest with you, I just know how hard it is for shows to drag audiences from one day part to another. Change is always hard for listeners and viewers and maybe readers too.
I mean, I think it's probably a good move for Chicago Tonight because I feel like the regular newscasts, and the networks or the local affiliates are pretty terrible right now, the 10 o'clock news. They almost always lead with some sort of mayhem, car crashes, murders, this and that, and don't get into anything sophisticated about it. They just shoot the have film of it and talk to a victim's family, and it's become so unhelpful as far as making people understand anything. And it's just become this kind of, we're going to go out and show city mayhem. That I just think 10 o'clock news on TV in Chicago is as bad as I've ever seen it be. And I think that Chicago Tonight can take advantage of that and offer something that's deeper, smarter, more sophisticated at 10 o'clock, and it may find an audience. Might find a bigger audience than it has now.
I don't watch enough 10 o'clock news to have as an informed opinion as maybe you guys do about this locally. But I would say that about journalism in Chicago generally, that it's so much about the numbers of crimes and the kinds of violence that numbs us. I think that there's a lot of lazy reporting out there. I've often said, if there's a million people in Chicago this weekend and 40 of them get shot, that's a terrible thing. But I just think there's some context that's missing. If you spend any time downtown Chicago, downtown, not the West Side, say, you'll see tourists and people with lanyards who are here for conventions and people that are shopping and eating in restaurants. And if you listen to some of these detractors, you would think, oh, my God, what are you doing going to downtown Chicago? It's dangerous. There's a lot of people who are in completely engaged in this city every day and often well into the evening to just every day say, here's the news, this many people were shot, completely ignores the success or the resurgence that the city is trying to have.
I will agree with that, but I'll add to it that, you know, just as crime, really needs to be tracked over multiple years to really get an insight, you can't really track crime over 6 months. You need to look at it over multiple years to see, you know, to see patterns and to see whether the ups and downs are really driven by something. And so even though downtown is robust and people are there for plays and concerts and that kind of thing, I can see there'd be a slow chipping away. You know, if we're looking at the numbers 10 years from now, we can look back that this could be a time when, you know, that downtown starts to recede from the highs that it had in the 90s with all the comeback of making downtown sort of an after 5 o'clock destination. A lot of that is driven by anecdotal evidence or things that happen to people. The more stuff starts happening to people and they start telling other people about it, I think that it starts having, and there's an erosion starts happening.
Well, I know when something bad happens, people tend to tell it more than when, and that, you know, nobody leads the news with a convention happened without incident downtown today. But if somebody gets shot at the convention, that's news. And people are the same way. I don't know how you balance it because I don't know if it's journalism to say a convention happened without incident, but I think therein lies the context I'm looking for. How do we balance out that presentation of what Chicago life is?
What Mark said is right. You look at numbers over years and over decades. And if you look like 15, 20 years ago, you know, crime was steadily going down. But even in that time period, if you would get in opinion polls, when you ask people whether they thought crime was getting better, they'd say no. They'd say crime was getting worse. They'd say they almost always when you ask people their opinion, they think crime is getting worse, whether it is or not.
Can I jump in about one little thing about Chicago tonight? Not to take you backwards, but I had one thing to say about that. And I agree with Mark that actually at 10 o'clock, I think that's a good spot because it goes everything he was saying about how television journalism really has just hit a real low. I think one thing that it does lose by moving from 7 o'clock, whether it's a half hour or an hour, I think half hour is probably better, is that there was kind of an urgency. When news happened during the day, you could then turn it on right after things happened. And, for instance, I remember I covered the Jussie Smollett trial and would see that, you know, they could get that stuff on right away after when the trial ended. And there was sort of that old classic kind of there's no more afternoon newspapers and there's no more evening newspapers. And so I think it kind of served that purpose, I think, being right there at the end of the day. And the second thing is I have elderly parents, like I'm sure many of us do. And my parents are long. They got me into Chicago Tonight. They watched it for, you know, however long it was on. And that viewership now ends because they're moving it to 10 o'clock because they're not going to be up at 10 o'clock to watch it.
I wonder if this is like, I'm never going to that store anymore because it's not Marshall Fields. But then you go to Macy's.
Well, I think they just won't be up. I mean, I think there's our people who look for
right. Right,
10 o'clock
right.
is late for them. And so I think that was part of the ritual of dinner. And after dinner, you watch Chicago Tonight. And they were able to, and that's the type of journalism where you do have to sit there, be alert. And I read someone's comment, maybe Eric was on your Facebook page, where someone said it was the type of thing where like they would settle back for. And just like it was one of those last things of priority, what do they call it, appointment viewing.
I'd be interested to see if they go live at 10 o'clock. They go live now at 7. And you go live at 10, one of the real advantages of Chicago Tonight is they would have state lawmakers on. They would have people who were just covering a story. They would have lawyers. all that trial, they would have this kind of news conference feel to some of their segments that would really go in depth. And yeah, the newscasts were saying this happened today at the trial, or this happened today in Springfield, but they would conduct, you know, 8-10 minute conversations with people who were right immediately involved in the story, and they were live. If you do it at 7, if you're going to do it at 7 o'clock, if Paris Schutz and Brandis Friedman and Amanda Vinicky and Heather Sharon and all those people are going to be going home at 7 o'clock, then, or before, if they're going to tape the show, then I don't see why moving it to 10 o'clock is a good idea. Now, maybe they're going to take it to 10, but then are these experts, these professors, these lawmakers, these professional experts, are they going to be willing to come to the studio or block off in the 10 o'clock half hour there to be on the show? I don't know. That's why I'm really taking a wait and see attitude toward it. I think that show is vital. It's been around for 37 years, I think. It's a terrific contribution to local journalism. I'm worried about it, but I'm not going to pass judgment yet.
Never before, or who knows, maybe ever before, have people been happier to see a new law that may not be effective or even constitutional, but the legislature has passed and the governor has signed into law a ban on the sale, delivery, and purchase of assault weapons in Illinois. If you have one, you'll need to tell the state police. Rapid fire add-ons are now illegally. It doesn't do everything advocates wanted. You can get a gun if you're 18, for instance. And many, including recent Republican candidate for Governor Darren Bailey, said they simply won't comply. Expect a court date on this, and at least one lawyer we talked to said, don't bet on it surviving. Eric, you and I talked about the constitutionality of this, and I know you've at least hoped, maybe felt, that it'll pass the muster, but I'm hearing other people say that with the Supreme Court configured the way it is, maybe not so much.
Well, that is the wild card, of course, but there are similar bans in 8 other states that seem to have survived at least a little while. And there are already laws on the books that restrict the right to bear arms. You can't have a shoulder-fired bazooka launcher and things like that. You can't have a machine gun, as we describe, an automatic gun without all kinds of restrictions being placed on you. So the idea that you can't have a restriction on certain kinds of weapons is, I don't think, true. And so it's going to be a fine legal argument, and I imagine that it will pass muster. I mean, I'm obviously not a lawyer, but the question then beyond that becomes, how effective are these bans? And the reading that I've done on it suggests that they're somewhat effective in reducing the number of deaths in mass shooting incidents, that especially if you restrict the high-capacity magazines and you restrict these weapons of war that they have, these so-called assault weapons, that you can reduce the casualty rate, that the overall effect on the murder rate is going to be pretty slight. So
this is recently, as December, I believe, in Oregon, there was a judge there who I think was a Trump-appointed judge who ruled that it was constitutional to regulate high-capacity magazines, and the reasoning was because they're so connected to these mass shootings that are happening all the time. And so I think that there is, I mean, so I agree with Eric. I think that there's a lot of nuances here that that don't bode well for the gun manufacturer's favor, because other state courts have not, you know, this, we've seen this, as they say, we've seen this play before, that it's already happened. So I do feel like the major, well, of course, saving one life is worth it for anything. But I think that the greater contributor to the gun violence is definitely the gun trafficking. And I think that is really the, how do you stop that? I think that's a greater challenge for, if the intent indeed is to stop these mass shootings.
I think it's a good idea. I mean, I just... can't see a rational reason somebody needs to have an AR-15 unless they want to, you know, mow down a convenience store full of people. It's not you know, a hunting, a sport thing. It's a kill people thing. And I do feel like that states like Illinois need to, you know, if these red states are going to have the ability to express the ethics and the values of the people by getting involved in what I would view as gun worship and you know, everyone should have a gun and all this other crap, then states like Illinois, where people don't feel that way, need to be able to, you know, to protect themselves by expressing their values. And so I would hope that this survives despite the radical Supreme Court. The other thing I want to say about this bill is that the impetus clearly was the Highland Park shooting of last year, but it really should be remembered that activists on the South and West sides have been fighting against gun violence in their communities for years and years and years. We're a driving force in this actually happening. And, you know, and this idea that, oh, this is a new kind of issue of the day that was just brought up by, you know, folks in the suburbs is just a bad way to look at it. My wife was down in Springfield for this, and she was telling me about just the influence of Black activists on this issue was so impressive to her. And that needs to be remembered, that this is not like a flavor of the month kind of issue that just came out of Highland Park. That was just a horrible example of why it was needed.
But the murder rate in Chicago, it would seem to me, wouldn't be impacted that much by this, right? I mean, the murder rate in Chicago, or just shootings in general, those right. are handguns, right? This isn't about handguns.
No, but it's about the gun safety movement. And that's and so anytime you can do something that reduces the lethality of guns, you should do it. And so does this specifically address the problem of some, you know, one gang member shooting another gang member? No, but it goes in the same direction.
That's why I think there's some real symbolic value to this if it survives the court challenge, that it says that we can do something, we can take steps, we can try to restrict access to firearms, and it is constitutional. And yeah, it's going to make a very small dent in the overall rate. But I mean, people like me, I got to say, after Sandy Hook and nothing happened to Sandy Hook, I mean, what was it? Was it 28 people killed there? 20, 21, 22 little kids killed? Yeah. And nothing happened. And I kind of gave up on the whole thing at that point. I said, like, okay, nothing's ever going to happen. I'm not going to waste any column space or any breath arguing about gun control, because this country is just not there. And the movement and a development like this tells me that maybe we are there, or we're getting there, or that it's still possible. And it's still something to think about and to strategize about. And if you have a good idea, maybe we can push it through, and maybe we can do a little something. Maybe we can curb some of this gun violence through laws. So it's got this symbolic value. This would boost the morale of people who have, like me, kind of given up on it.
Well, you say we are there, we're not there. I think we've been there all along, right? I mean, I think that if you did a public opinion survey, surely it existed at the time of Sandy Hook, all the way through Highland Park. A majority of people in the country and in Illinois, and I'll bet in most states, would be for this kind of gun legislation.
You are hearing those voices after something like Highland Park happens, but you don't hear them as consistently. You hear the louder voices, which I agree with you, I think are in the minority, the Darren Baileys of the world, saying they're going to defy the ban and all that other stuff. I mean, I think that they're extremist voices that, like every other topic that's going on in the world right now, we just hear the extremists more than mm-hmm. people. I talk, you know, for my job, I talk to people. Just this past week, I talked to a mother whose kid was in the school where a sixth grader brought a gun to school and shot his teacher. And I talked to a mom who kind of didn't really think about the gun issue before. She was not a gun owner, but she was that it made her into at least an activist for this week about, like, why are we having, I mean, that wasn't a high capacity magazine in that case, but just the idea of, like, why isn't there even a conversation about this? And I think that the more this becomes reality to people, sadly, I think that it's even going to be more of the majority. But I agree with you. I think the polling shows the majority of people are for this. I think it's just there's this fear to really kind of push through this legislation.
That's why a political victory like this is so important, is because I mean, for decades, 90% of Americans in polls have said that they wanted, you know, that they wanted a universal background check for gun sales. Still didn't happen. And that's because of lobbyists. It's because of the passion of that 10%. And so that's why developing momentum is so important, political momentum, and really making it cost lawmakers when they vote against things like this.
So would we now the ninth state to have this kind of legislation? But if it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, who knows? Mark, you made me think about the six-year-old who shot a teacher in Virginia last week, which is just such a bizarre story. Took a gun out of the mom's backpack and brought it to school and then aimed it at and intentionally, by all the reporting on it, fired it at the teacher. Didn't kill the teacher, but wow. You can't prosecute that kid as an adult. It's not even clear what juvenile laws would apply to a six-year-old. And so we're all trying to figure out, what do we do about a case like this? I'm not sure what the laws in Virginia say, but if one of the parents went to jail for a while on that, I'd be okay.
It's one of those issues. It's such a one-off. And I don't know what age you start holding parents responsible. You've got kids as young as 12, 13, 14 who are out on the streets with guns, and I don't know that their parents have any kind of control over them, and I think their parents are heart sick, a lot of them, about what their kids are doing and running around, and I don't know that punishing them under the law is going to make a difference.
Well, I think that there is a trend now among prosecutors to go after the parents, and started the landmark one is the one still going out with the Crumbleys outside Detroit, whose son. Boy, I don't remember the specifics of it, but may have gotten a gun on his birthday, or she got a gun enabled by the parents and shot and killed a bunch of people. And I think we're seeing it with Highland Park, where they're going after the dad there. There is kind of a trend to now scrutinizing the parents to see if they're lives will be destroyed if their kid somehow is encouraged to have access to a gun when they're not of age.
It could be such a simple mistake, right? Like, I'm a lawful gun owner, and I believe there's plenty of smart, fair, responsible people who make the simple mistake of not safeguarding their gun, and a child gets to it, and then bad things happen. Even as I suggested that one of the parents go to jail, I see the problem with that, right? That how does that make that kid, that family, or any of us safer after one person makes a tragic mistake?
Well, the bar will be pretty high. In the Crumbly family situation, the parents purchased a 9mm handgun for their teenager when he was only 15 years old.
If you make an example out of the parents, then you know, you can just see a parent saying, "No, son, you're not going to get a gun at this age. Maybe 3 years from now, because you know I'm not going to jail for you."
Yeah,
I mean, creating that sense of worry in parents' minds will increase their responsibility, hopefully.
Including in the case of a six-year-old, you will not make that mistake. It'll be that much more top of mind.
You will lock up your gun.
Can I just say that Crumbly is one of the best Dickensian names in all of
right. the other thing
is that you know, in the case of Robert Crimo, the suspect in Highland Park, I'm not sure how you say his name, that his father bought him the gun or helped or facilitated his purchase of the gun, but he was legally, he was over the age of 18 when he fired those shots in the parade. I don't know how that, if he fired the shots when he was under 18, that might have made a difference. I'm not sure how they're going to get the father. I know they've charged him on this, but I don't quite know what the law would be that would say that, well, he had this gun when he was younger, but he didn't do anything bad with it until he was legally an adult. So I'm just not sure about that case.
Well, this law is no panacea, that's for sure. But it seems like so many young men around 17, 18, 19, 20, 21 have issues and have access to these kinds of guns. And the guns, the appearance of the guns, they say, oh, we're just going to ban the gun because it's ugly. And I'm like, yeah, I think I am, because these kids are so impressionable. Those guns are so sexy and powerful, and it's so easy for them to get them that it's not going to reduce the crime rate in Chicago, but it might reduce the number of mass homicides. Eric, I was disappointed in the statistic you quoted. You said it was like, you know, marginally more effective in stopping these kinds of shootings. I would think it would be fantastically effective in stopping these kinds of shootings if we made it almost impossible for these people to get those kinds of guns.
I'm not saying that they're not. I mean, I think the research shows that, at least that I read, and the Washington Post fact checker is my source on this, and they were saying that it is effective in reducing the number of casualties in these mass shooting incidents. The thing is that mass shootings are not that common. They're far too common and depressingly common, but they're not the main source of gun violence and gun death in this country. Is not mass shooting, so that you can have an impact on the number of deaths in mass shootings. And I think that is significant. I think I don't want to leave that impression. But to just the overall effect on gun deaths, gun violence is going
even
to
be fairly small.
But I mean, but even given that, I mean, I'm siding with Mark and talking about this, you know, the political momentum that happens with a law like this. That even if it doesn't really drastically reduce the number of gun deaths, it's still a really salutary thing that's happened here, I believe, and that it shows the way toward perhaps other legislation that might be more effective.
Okay, Congressman George Santos says he's not going to quit. He was approached by reporters at the Capitol today. It was a scene that looked like a lot of what happens when a squirrel or a cat suddenly finds itself in the outfield at a baseball game and everyone's chasing it. And as soon as someone gets close to the cat or the congressman, it darts the other way. He had his phone to his ear like, no, I'm on a busy call right now. Later, Santos tweeted, "I was elected to serve the people, not the party and the politicians. I remain committed to doing that and regret to hear that local officials refuse to work with my office to deliver the results that will make our community safe and lower the cost of living. I will not resign." So now he's on the righteous high horse and he's a victim here.
Yeah, that's the playbook. I think there's going to be scarier things about him that are going to come out even more so.
Well, an interesting aspect of that today was Nassau County Republicans coming out and demanding his resignation. I thought that was, unfortunately, a very rare case of Republicans doing the right thing and really showing some standards. I mean, it was refreshing. It was almost like, you know, where did you come from, like the 1960s Republican? Because for them to come out and do that. But I was impressed by it because if there's another election, the Republicans may well lose that seat. And which is one of the reasons that Kevin McCarthy, who doesn't believe in anything except power and money and influence, isn't doing anything about Santos. But for them to come out and demand they resign and that a new election be held, I thought was very impressive. And so there is pressure building in certain ways. It's just that none of it's coming from House Republican leadership because it is completely bankrupt of any values or morals or ethics. I mean, you look at McCarthy, Scalise, Stefanik. I mean, I don't know where you find an ethic in any of the three of them. They don't believe in anything other than just
Miller, Boebert, Gates, all those people. Yeah, you're right. I want to know where the Nassau County Republicans were during the campaign.
Yeah.
Apparently, there was a weekly, a Long Island weekly that published some of this material before the election, but that the Democrats, who were also asleep at the switch, we're right. Just saying, oh, Santos, he's too MAGA, he's too Trump friendly, and not focusing in on his resume, which was just larded with lies. And you're right, the Republican leadership is not going to try to oust him because they're afraid of the special election. That district, New York 3rd, has traditionally been Democratic leaning. I know they redrew the boundaries, but this was a district that the Democrats, I think, were hopeful to win, and if there's a special election, they could well win it. And the Republicans don't want it. They can't. They have almost no wiggle room with their majority in the House. They don't want to have it's a 4-seat majority now. They can have a 3-seat. So they don't want to mess with that possibility. But if they're thinking long term, showing yourself as the party of integrity, and we're the ones who are going to demand that he leave, we're going to hold special election, that gives you a better long-term chance of hanging on to that seat, because I think Mark is right that in 2 years, Santos is going to go down in flames. I doubt he's going to have the nerve to even to run again. So,
well, he may lose in a primary if he does run again, you know, because I think the Nassau County Republicans have smartly viewed it as he's long-term, you know, toxic to them. And so they want to distance themselves from him so they can run somebody else in 2 years. But think about it. This guy's going to have a vote in a very closely contested House for the next 2 years. You know what? Just a guy who defrauded the voters. I mean, he has committed fraud. He is stealing a Democratic system from the people of that district. And I mean, the latest thing I was just reading today, the latest thing he claimed supposedly was that he was a star volleyball player at Baruch College. I mean, it's like the list of things, which somebody said, I think Chris Hayes tweeted, was like one of the most absurd and hilarious claims that you could possibly make. And I mean, where does it end? I mean, the guy was working at a call center and then a year or two later was donating $700,000 to his own campaign. So I want an explanation of that.
That's the thing I'm curious about. I mean, that's a trait. He can tell all the lies he wants, but if somehow he generated $700,000 and the year before he made $30,000 or $40,000, where did he get $700,000? And his business documents don't say where the money came from. And I don't even care if that's an election law that he broke. I just want to know who's given him the money, who's pulling the strings. Where does the money come from? Right. Have you guys heard of any explanation for that?
No, I mean, I think the one that we're going to get is going to be pretty nefarious. I mean, it's going to be either one of these, you know, super wealthy, kind of very right wing people shoveling money at him, or it's going to be foreign interests. You know, I mean, what he's doing as far as funny money is not that much different from the former president of the United States and his funny money. I mean, for both of them, it's a situation where did they get the money is a giant question.
But you know, 2 years is a long time, and I'm thinking you guys have written this guy off even at a primary level. In 2 years, he's going to be if he's a regular Republican vote. Look, they tried to get Herschel Walker into the U.S. Senate because he'd just be a solid Republican vote. One wonders, at the risk of electing a Democrat, calculate the incumbency factor. You know, if he doesn't do anything wrong but just delivers Republican votes for the next 2 years, I don't know what would happen in 2 years.
Well, he'd probably get Elise Stefanik's endorsement.
Well, he would certainly get the votes of many Republicans in a general election, but I think Mark is right to point to the primary, that if the Nassau County Republicans and other organizations in that area decide they're going to get behind somebody else, they could easily beat him in a primary.
Do they have the ability? You can't fire him, right?
The House of Representatives could vote. I believe it's a 2/3 vote. It would be required to kick him out, which you're not going to get under present circumstances because Republicans, you know, lying as part of the platform. So they're not going to really go after him. And they might be prodded by, you know, an indictment. And there are, I think, four different, you know, official investigations of him. The real problem is that election law violations have just been kind of poo-pooed. Nobody cares about him in the last 10 or 20 years. It's people get away with all kinds of terrible stuff. And that's part of why, you know, terrible people run for office and get elected, is because we don't really enforce our election laws in any kind of real way. And it's total slap on the wrist time. And Republicans especially, but corrupt people in both parties have diminished the effectiveness of the Federal Election Commission and the, you know, the ethics committees and stuff like that. They've really kind of defanged them to where it cheating on elections is not really a problem. I mean, Trump, you remember that Michael Cohen was convicted of an election violation with the Stormy Daniels thing. And clearly Trump was, you know, individual A in that. He was the main individual one, I think it was called. He was the one who authorized that illegal payment to Stormy Daniels. But nobody charged Trump. No, why didn't they? I don't know. The prosecutors don't have to explain why they don't. But people get away with cheating on campaign finance stuff all the time, and that's why it keeps on happening.
I'm thinking of the emoluments clause, too. I mean, I suppose we could make a list, Mark, of things that we know are violations, but we just don't seem to be motivated to do anything about it.
Right. And if anyone in any past president had done anything like the emoluments stuff that Trump did, you know, there would have been a big deal. But I feel like Trump really kind of buried us in corruption to where, you know, nobody could focus on any one thing because there are so many things. Yeah. Or it was all just a pretend thing and nobody really cares about corruption in this country.
Well, is there a similarity between the presidential documents case of Joe Biden now and the presidential documents case of Donald Trump? Are those the same thing in any way?
Superficially, a little bit, but what really distinguishes them is a level of cooperation or lack of cooperation from President Biden's people, quickly turned over those documents when they found them, and they didn't push back about any of the efforts to recover those documents. And Trump's team has been fighting them and hiding them and lying about it all along. I mean, I think that the similarities are like I say, superficial but very slight, and that the arguments to the other side you're hearing on Fox News are pretty pathetic.
They're spending a lot of time on it based on my silent screen viewing. I just keep seeing that up on the screen and people sitting around talking about it. And I found myself thinking, okay, well, maybe if you're a president or vice president, you deal with so many documents and you are so mobile that it's only natural that you're going to find things in a closet and go, oh, crap, how did that get there? But I didn't throw that bone to Donald Trump. So then I'm wondering how fair it is to give Joe Biden the same pass.
Actually, they did throw that bone to Donald Trump, and he lied about it and kept the records. I mean, if Donald Trump had given up the records when the National Archives had asked for them, no big deal. No, we wouldn't be talking about a prosecution. Instead, he lied about it. He had his lawyer promised that they'd given everything up when they hadn't. That was extended lying to authorities and hiding evidence over more than a year's time. And so, I mean, if Donald Trump had done what Joe Biden has done, it wouldn't be a big deal for either one of them.
Let's just stay in the Congress for a second here. Last time we gathered, the Rascals were discussing the fate of Kevin McCarthy and his quest to become the Speaker of the House. He's the Speaker of the House, so now what? And the last time we gathered, Heather Sharon suggested government will need to pass funding legislation and that it could be then that we see who's really in charge of the House of Representatives or how chaotic things can be. I don't know. Do you guys see any writing on the wall right now? How consequential is it that Kevin McCarthy won, but he's got to make compromises to these people?
It does seem that his power is crippled moving forward, that, as you just mentioned, kind of squeaked in there because of those concessions, that they have greater power to remove him or just make his life really miserable.
It does seem like he's going to be trying to herd cats with this caucus of his, this fractious caucus that he's got. What's going to be interesting to see what happens like when they face things like the debt limit and the debt ceiling and trying to crash through that again. And when you've got these 20 red hots who have outsized representation on some of the key committees, you're going to have a hard time getting anything through. Now, of course, the counter argument is that the House doesn't matter that much for the next 2 years because, I mean, in most areas, they may pass all kinds of nutty laws. None of them will make it to the Senate or to President Biden's desk. They will be able to hold endless hearings on Hunter Biden's laptop and anything else, then Benghazi maybe again, God knows. And they may also be able to hold up certain spending bills and hold the American public hostage to their most extreme demands. That's what I'm worried about when it comes to what McCarthy can and can't do. I mean, to my mind, the whole party is in thrall to Donald Trump and to this nihilistic form of government. So I don't know how much difference it's going to make that the 20 most extreme members have more power in real terms.
The whole party? I thought that maybe the midterm showed that maybe the coattails aren't that long for Donald Trump. You've got these 20 hotheads who are in a position of leverage, but how extensive is that now,
well,
Eric?
Let's not kid ourselves about Kevin McCarthy or Steve Scalise or some of the people who were in the so-called or portrayed as moderate Republicans. They're pretty extreme right wingers, and so I think that the party has moved dramatically to the right.
Let's be honest about it. It's a fascist party. It's a party that does not it's very, very little resemblance to a Republican Party of the 70s or 80s or 90s. The best case scenario for the American people is that the House Republicans show who they are for the next 2 years, block spending, try to, you know, block the debt ceiling stuff and really make the U.S. look shaky economically and just do all this just horrible crap that just infuriates normal American people who actually understand that government has a purpose in our lives. And they will view those people as vandals, and they should. If that's the case, knock on wood, MAGA Republicans lose badly in 2024.
Knock it on wood over here.
Donald Trump got 70 million votes last time. You know, that it does make you scratch your head. It is kind of different, too, in that Trump was a bit of a cult figure. I don't know how you describe the Republicans in the House, but it's not a single magnetic personality.
Well, don't you think that, to me, the biggest question in the Republicans' future is whether this kind of charisma magic that Trump had, and I never understood it. I always thought he was an extremely off-putting person, but somehow he had this magnetism for some people. And the real question to me is whether that translates to anyone else, to Ron DeSantis, to, you know, who knows, to Mike Pompeo, who knows. But is that translatable and transferable? If it is, then the country is in a big problem, is in big trouble in 2024. If not, then the Republican Party will, you know, crash and burn, and some rational elements of it, if any still exist and haven't been expelled, will try to build a new Republican Party out of it.
I my sense is it's not. You saw what happened at the midterms, that a lot of a lot of those people did win for sure, but, you know, a lot of them didn't. Trump separated himself from those people. He was already on TV. He had been on television for decades. He is an entertainer, and it's sort of this kind of like a crazy, wacky guy. He was such a unique thing. And I think the rest of these people are beyond being backbenchers. They are backbenchers. They're on the very last bench. And I think that's why a lot of them didn't win. I think I don't think that really transfers to these people, because they really come across as bumbling. And I think people are, I'm obviously generalizing here, but I think we see it. I think that midterm election was the first of what I think are going to be many signs that people just are not, are kind of falling out of love with that stuff.
Trump was trying to drag McCarthy over the finish line and couldn't do it for so many rounds that people were not listening to Trump. Trump got one vote for Speaker of the House. I remember reading something a couple months ago about the idea. There was a serious thought that they could vote Donald Trump to be the Speaker of the House, because you don't have to actually be a congressman. Anyone could have been Speaker of the House. But he got one vote. So it may be that the bloom is off the rose a little bit with Trump. And now that he's been at the head of the party through several lost election cycles, that they may think, do we really want to try to ride this aging horse one more time? I don't think so.
And I think it's the Democrats, it's their, these races, it's theirs to lose. And that's why, kind of going back to this thing of the classified documents with Biden and everything, and I agree with everything everybody said here, but I do think that the Democrats do, if I was an advisor for the party, they do are held to a different standard, like it or not, they are. And so doing stupid stuff like that is red meat that works really well in elections. I remember with the whole thing with Hunter Biden, which I think is total BS and all that, but it's like, can these people just let their kids find their own jobs? It kind of comes down to that. It's sort of like they did kind of create the situation in many ways.
I actually think that's very well stated. And I think that the Democrats just have to be better than the Republicans. Because the Republicans' whole argument is not, we're not terrible. Their argument is, they're terrible too. You know, you always see that, which is, I mean, to me, it's a weird campaign slogan to say, we're, you know, they're terrible as, just like us. It seems like a weird campaign slogan, but it's the kind of strategy that Trump has always used. You know, and the thing about that is that just erodes the whole idea of American idealism and the idea that we should really expect anything from our politicians. But yeah, the Democrats, they can't screw up like this. It's really bad. And the thing about it is, I don't hear anyone who's rational saying, well, what Biden did was okay. It was no problem. And, you know, which is when Trump did it, you saw a lot of people on the right saying, that's no problem. It's perfectly okay for him to do that, because it's all partisanship and it's no values. But rational people realize that what Biden did here is screw up. I don't think it was a giant screw up, but it was a screw up. He shouldn't have done it. Rational people who actually have values and care about things and want their government to be good, you know, should be demanding that Democrats get punished when they do bad things. Mm-hmm. And they should, for example, the Hunter Biden thing. If Hunter Biden committed a crime, I want him prosecuted. You know, I want the government to investigate thoroughly, determine whether he committed crimes, and if he did, I want him charged. And it's not like, oh, he's Joe Biden's son, so I think that he should be let off. I don't think that. And I think that that's why Democrats have to be for even-handed government, not for partisan government.
I want to talk about the Chicago mayoral race for just a couple minutes with you guys. The Lightfoot campaign has dropped a couple of commercials where she's tough on crime. It's interesting that in the one commercial where they talk about how she's doing a pretty good job, things are getting better, it's not perfect yet. It's not Lori Lightfoot saying it, but it's other people speaking on her behalf. The spot also says that the haters are going to hate, or they use the expression haters, that people are always going to dislike Lori Lightfoot, but they're haters.
First of all, calling people who are critics of her results on crime haters is not a really good way to lead into persuading people who are on the fence about her. The second thing is she talks about how, you know, this whole ad is about Lori Lightfoot has a plan. And this is the kind of thing that you hear from a challenger, not an incumbent. She's had 4 years, and it's been a tough 4 years, no question about it. She had to deal with a pandemic, and crime everywhere spiked during the pandemic. It has, the levels have not come down, but for her to try to fudge the numbers. Sun-Times had a pretty good story on Wednesday morning talking about what the crime numbers actually show, and not just murder numbers, but the overall crime numbers. And it shows that the number of police officers, that those numbers are not necessarily trending in the right direction. So for her to say, I've got a plan, the voter, I think, is going to ask himself or herself, well, you've had 4 years to execute your plan. Well, where you been? So, like I said, the whole thing struck me as just like her ad where she almost breaks into tears talking about her mother. It struck me as the kind of commercial that's run by challengers, not incumbents.
I am kind of gobsmacked at Lori Lightfoot and her strategy here. It's getting worse. It just keeps getting worse. Every time you think it's bad, it keeps getting worse. She must not be listening to anyone, or I don't know who she has around her, but it's like she started at this high point in the top of this term and was socked with COVID, which was a really difficult thing for every mayor across the country to deal with, and no doubt. And she, I think, gets high marks for that from voters. But with this crime issue, this idea of talking about crime is a real crisis in the city. As a criticism of her personally, that's how she's taking it, is kind of amazing to me, you know, and you just don't see any action by this mayor to really sort of acknowledge that there's a real issue with, and she goes on the offensive against her critics. I don't understand how she thinks this is a winning strategy.
I agree. I think her messaging is terrible. And it also, it defies anyone who has the ability to remember back 3.5 years or 4 years, because if you remember, when we were last paying attention to this, Lori Lightfoot won election as mayor fairly handily, even though she was an outsider, and every single ward,
yeah.
Right, and she ran as a reformer, overwhelmingly won. Everyone was very hopeful. It was wow. So this idea that this haters thing is ridiculous. I mean, it's not like nobody went into her first term hating Lori Lightfoot. Everyone was saying, wow, this isn't this cool. I hope it works for the city after all this corruption in the machine and all this other stuff. And so for her to act like, you know, somebody has something personally out against her is stupid. And I think most people won't buy it. She expended all that goodwill. She wasted all that goodwill. She just threw it out the window with being a bully and being mean and being rude to people and not trying to develop kind of these coalitions and just not doing any of the right things. I mean, I live in the suburbs. I'm not a city resident, but I sure pay a lot of attention to it. And I really wanted Lori Lightfoot to be a good mayor.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I thought she might be. I mean, I thought there was more chance of her being a good mayor than almost anyone who had been elected in the last, you know, 3 or 4 decades since I've lived in Chicago. And it didn't happen. It turned out that she had some sort of personality problem where she didn't get along with people, and she had to try to bully people. She had to try to lie about stuff. And it's extremely disappointing. And for her to, like, you know, pull out, you know, her mom and all that, you know, let's run her mom. Let's not run her. Let's run her mayor. Your mom seems like a really nice person. You wouldn't send any of those mean emails that she was caught sending.
Well, what her defenders would say is that mayors and Chicago mayors have been thin-skinned and nasty, going back through Emanuel and the Dailies for generations. And so to pick on Lori Lightfoot for being thin-skinned and nasty is sexist. Now, I don't necessarily buy that, but that is, I think, the counter-argument that you're going to get from her. She certainly has invoked her race, gender, and sexual orientation before in terms of defending herself or using that as a reason why she's being criticized.
You know, Rich, Eric, which nobody cares about. You know, nobody in Chicago, they don't care whether she's black. They don't care whether she's gay. They don't care whether she's short. They don't care about any of those things. They just want her to be a good mayor.
I agree. I'm just saying what her defenders would
but
say.
I would answer those defenders and say, yes, you're right. There have always been. And I was thinking about Rahm Emanuel because he was the one who I thought he was he was nasty for sure. But he was able to control situations. He had responses. You feel with her that her only response is, you're being mean to me because I'm short. You're being mean to me because I'm a woman. And I think that's what's driving. I think Mark hit it on the head. I think that's driving voters here crazy because no one cares about those things. It didn't matter in her in her election. She came in, she won every single ward as an outsider because people liked her. In my neighborhood, there were cardboard cutouts of her in the windows during COVID as sort of like an, they were rallying around her because they loved what she was doing with COVID by being really stern. That sternness really worked for that. That's all gone. And it's driving, I think, people crazy. I feel like they're being gaslit by their own mayor.
Well, I think she's right. There are a lot of people that really don't like her. I don't know if they hate her or not, but yeah, she's got haters out there. But
they all have haters. That's the thing is, you have haters. I've got a byline. I have haters. We all have haters. You're on the radio. I'm sure people don't like you. You know, the thing is, and I think that's life.
And I want to underscore what Mark said, which is that she won 74% of the vote 4 years ago over an established and pretty well respected Democratic politician, Tony Preckwinkle. 74% of the vote. So to say that she's lost all this goodwill because she's got all these haters out there, I think it clangs. It really does.
I was certainly among.
I voted for her twice. I voted for her in the first round and of course in the second round, and I had high hopes for her. I feel like she has deserved a lot of the criticism that she's gotten. I don't consider myself a hater. I consider myself a critic and an observer. I think dismissing me or anyone who is challenging her record on crime and on getting things done as a hater is not a smart strategy.
You know, and I said that she had a messaging problem, and she doesn't really have a messaging problem. She has a performance problem. Mm. And if you have a performance problem, you have to have brilliant messaging to kind of overcome it. And that's where she's failed in both cases, frankly.
I think that's where we're going back to the Rahm situation. I think you're right. I mean, I think that he had a messaging problem, but he didn't have a performance problem.
We could get into that, but Rahm is a very sneaky mayor who could not be trusted at face value.
Oh yeah, that's for sure.
Ooh, that's for another podcast. I'll have to ask you guys to give me a history lesson. I mean, I think I know a little bit about what you're talking, but I think Chicago will remember Rahm Emanuel finished that sentence. Is a good mayor, a bad mayor? Forget sneaky. Was he a good mayor for the city of Chicago? Sneaky sometimes gets the job done.
I think he'll be remembered by people who were through it for one thing, Laquan McDonald. I think that is the thing that prevented him from running a third term. Because during Rahm Emanuel, you had all these street protests start to happen that didn't happen in my life. You know, I didn't see it happen to that. And actually, it worked. Those street protests led to actual change, you know. And so now that all those leaders are now all galvanized and organized, so when Lori Lightfoot shows up, they just press the green button. They're all engaged in going after her. And so I think that he's going to be remembered for Laquan McDonald and the devastating effects that had.
Well, and that brings up the thing that's really plagued, you know, every Chicago mayor, you know, for decades, which is, until you confront the police union, you're not going to be able to make this a truly livable city, because the police union in many respects, is inherently racist. It's run by people who are extreme radicals and way out of touch with the way regular and most Chicagoans think and feel. And they will not get the trust of the black community because they've abused the black community for so long. And until you do something, until the police union can no longer hold the mayor hostage, which has happened a lot. It certainly happened under Emanuel, and it's happened under Lightfoot, too. Until you can stop that from happening, I don't see how a mayor can really succeed in the city. Yeah. So what has to happen is whoever becomes mayor needs to confront and defeat the police union. And until that happens, I don't think you really get...
Makes you wonder if the endorsement for Paul Vallis is going to help him as much. It's probably going to help him more than it hurts him, but how much is it going to help him? It makes you wonder. Guys, we're out of time. Mark, you know, when we set this up, you didn't mention that you have a book out, Mark Guarino's Country and Midwestern Chicago and the History of Country Music and Folk Revival, with a foreword by Robbie Foulkes.
Yes, well, it's out in April. I'm just telling people about, we're getting it all geared up now, but in April, that's when
coming out in April.
Pre-orders are available now, though.
Got it.
Pre-orders will help, though, right?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, they're pretty pleased with the pre-orders.
So in the beginning of these things, when we say, hey, I'm Mark Guarino, you're supposed to say, I have a fabulous book coming out in April. Don't you know how to do this sort of thing?
I got to learn that self-promotion. I got to
get into radio, man. You'll learn it overnight.
Author. Call yourself an author.
Best-selling author of the yet-to-be-released book. That's great.
I have in my crystal ball, it's best-selling.
Yes. Good to see and hear you guys. Eric, as always. Fellas, thanks for being part of the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman, and I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week. All right, fellas. Took a lot of your time today.
Thanks for having me. I got to jump, but thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I've kept you longer than I should. Thank you all.
Thanks, guys.
Of course.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.